There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm here, as always, with my colleague and co-host, Susan Simpson. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rabia. I know we say this literally every single week, but this week was a doozy, right?
This was a really bad one. And also, apologies to our listeners. We're coming to you a couple of days late. I take full responsibility for that. All kinds of stuff was going down. But it just means there's more news for you. There's so much news that I swear
by. Too much news.
Yeah, we easily could go on for like 2.5 hours, but hopefully we won't do that. I'm just going to start by reporting a couple of quick little pieces of news that came out today. I thought it was interesting, and then we're going to do some deep dives into the bigger stories. The first is this. We know our president loves Twitter. He uses it to, I guess, dictate policy and make demands on Department of Justice. Well, a federal court just decided that Trump can no longer block people on Twitter. There's a lawsuit that's been ongoing for a while, and this district court judge, and I'm guessing, I don't know if they're going to appeal it, said, well, you know what? This is protected by the First Amendment, and so this judge says he can't do it, that Trump and Dan Scavino, who is the White House social media director, they exert governmental control over certain aspects of the @RealDonaldTrump account. But the DOJ, which, by the way, is representing Trump on this matter, and that kind of burns me. I feel like, why are we wasting flipping DOJ resources on this crap? Said that we are going to be considering our next steps. So
I've not had a chance to read the opinion yet. But even aside from the Trumpiness of it, it's a really interesting issue. Definitely a, you know, brave new frontier where we are. Obviously, it's Trump, so it's going to be quicker before the courts and like more scandally, I guess, or whatever. But this issue probably was going to happen eventually anyway. But one interesting part of the court's ruling I did see is that the court made a distinction based on muting and blocking. And that Trump can mute people. Like, he's free to mute whoever he wants.
Right.
But he can't block them from stop them from seeing his communications because he doesn't like their viewpoints. So you're not Trump is not required to hear your tweets, but he is required to not block you from seeing his tweets, which, despite his sometimes claims, is definitely his official account.
Well, they're going to take this up all the way to the Supreme Court probably. And then he'll win.
Well, who knows? We'll see.
Maybe.
Because this is not a Trump-only issue. So I'm sure they'll be... I'm curious to see what happens.
I mean, how is it kind of not a Trump... Are there any other, like, public... government... Who are, like, block people?
Oh, yeah. It happens all the time, like, on Facebook. Yeah. On Facebook, there's a lot of politicians who've gotten into this situation where if people try and respond to, like, their campaign pages, they'll block them. So what's interesting, though, is that it's based on, like, the platform, how it's set up. Because not all platforms have a mute versus a block. So on Facebook, how would it apply? And what if Twitter changed its rules and no longer had a mute? Would blocking still be not allowed? So it's a really interesting issue, even aside from the current political climate.
Well, let's see how it goes down. Hopefully the justices understand what actually is going on Twitter. If only.
They'll be like, one sentence ruling, no one should ever tweet.
Right.
So ordered.
Actually, this applies to both of his accounts, right? Like, not just the POTUS account, but also his personal account, which is what he uses a lot more than the POTUS account, actually.
The POTUS account isn't really an account. It just retweets.
It just retweets. It does more officially type of stuff. The ranting he does on his personal account, but... Well, some good news for the White House. His son-in-law, Trump's son-in-law, Kushner, just got his security clearance after a very long time of not having it or being suspended or whatever it was. He had an interim one, and then it was, like, I think suspended or something. And so now he gets access once again to all kinds of high-level intel. Good on you, Jared Kushner.
Which is really strange and really concerning, given that there's so many... Well, one,
so just aside from even...
Like, one, he's just incredibly terrible at the paperwork, which itself is a basis for barring a security clearance. He shouldn't have needed like 1,000 redos on that report. But also there are a lot of concerning allegations that he has been influence peddling, that he has been using access to secret materials to do things he should not, like, you know, help his business or give it to the Saudi crown prince so he can purge his enemies. Again, not proven. maybe this was all speculation and did not actually happen in real life, and that's why they're not concerned by it. But his use of his government ties to promote his family's business are pretty widely reported on.
That is pretty much everybody who's like connected to Trump. Like everybody is using one another, and that's what we're going to be talking about a lot today too. Is you know, from Cohen to Broidy to like, I mean, it's just this is how his entire ecosystem operates.
I mean, there's a million scandals, but really they're all one scandal. It seems like it's everything. It seems like there's a million things going on, but really it's a lot of facets of the same one scandal, which is the naked corruption.
Yeah. I think what it is they thought that you could do the same thing like they do in business in general, like with the presidency. And they just never were able to make like an ethical distinction between, you know, this office and their business as usual, which is really this is how they do stuff, right? Like kickbacks and this and that. And
well, I think he's been on the other side of the equation so long, he figured that all people on the government side like that. He's been bribing government officials. He's been making these kind of dirty deals, or like semi-dirty deals, or just the general, like not necessarily illegal, not necessarily a crime, but just kind of gross sort of influence trading. So the fact he's doing it on just as big a scale from the inside probably isn't surprising, but is definitely beyond the norm, even in politics they were.
Well, there has been a like literally breathtaking amount of news that's come out in the last week.
Let's start with what happened last. So right when we left off last episode, we're talking about the financial disclosures that Trump had due and if they'd come out or not. They did come out. He did file them on time, barely. And we have them now. I have not had time to go through in detail and look at all the numbers. There's nothing there that's...
And these are Trump's disclosures, right?
Yeah.
The president's financial disclosures. Okay.
They don't show too... Like, from what we can tell from there's no higher level review of it, there's not too much that stands out, except for, like, for instance, he has new businesses he's making, or his company or his trust are making, that are generating profits. So he's still engaged in that. He still has a lot of his foreign operations, you know, bringing in management fees, bringing in operation fees. It's a little hard to compare like the overall rates given that the different time periods of reporting periods, like the last disclosure he filed covered a larger period of time than this one did. So you can't really do an apples to apples comparison. I'm sure you can do the math, but it's harder to calculate exactly whether the revenues increased or decreased or what. But there's one very interesting part of it. And this is the question everyone's wondering before, which is the Stormy Daniels debt. As financial disclosures don't just require like your income, they require you to disclose like what you owe and who you owe it to. And in his last disclosure in 2017, there was nothing about any kind of debt that could have been owed to Michael Cohen, his attorney. This time around, there was on the disclosure page for the debts, it was not listed as a disclosure, but as a footnote. He wrote, "In the interest of transparency, while not required to be disclosed as reportable liabilities on Part B, in 2016, expenses were incurred by one of Donald J. Trump's attorneys, Michael Cohen. Mr. Cohen sought reimbursement of those expenses, and Mr. Trump fully reimbursed Mr. Cohen in 2017. The category of value would be $100,000 to $250,000, and the interest rate would be zero." This is the Stormy payment.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
It doesn't detail, like, what the payment is for, though, right? Reimbursement. It's not like travel expenses, lunches and dinners.
Yeah, but despite his attempt to claim it's a reimbursement and therefore not a debt, which doesn't work, it also did not satisfy the OGE, Office of Government Ethics, because they wrote a letter promptly to Rosenstein. And it says, "Dear Mr. Rosenstein, I write to you in connection with the complaint by Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington on March 8th with the DOJ and OGE. The argument in the letter was basically that the payment to Mr. Cohen was a loan, should have been disclosed as a liability. So here is what the acting director of OGA said. "Today, I certified President Trump's financial disclosure report signed on May 15th, 2018. OGE has concluded that based on the information provided as a note to Part 8, the payment made by Mr. Cohen is required to be reported as a liability. OGE has determined that the information provided in that note meets the disclosure requirements for reportable liability under the Ethics in Government Act. I am providing both reports to you because you may find the disclosure relevant to any inquiry you may be pursuing regarding the president's prior report that was signed on June 14, 2017. In other words, this was a debt. It did exist at the time of the last filing and was not included in the last filing, which would appear to constitute a violation of the Ethics in Government Act.
But would that be within the purview of the inquiry? I mean, like, I wasn't clear about that because, you know, the letter says it might be relevant to... Any inquiry? Like, is there inquiry about the prior reporting?
Well, there is.
I didn't know there was.
Filing a false disclosure would be a criminal act. There's ongoing investigations into the president's finances of the Mueller investigation. So all this is saying.
It's in like, general, right. But I didn't know there was one about that disclosure. But okay. Maybe they know something.
Well, yeah. Apparently, he thought this would be relevant. So there's a suggestion that there's more trouble on the Stormy front than is otherwise made public.
Speaking of which, Stormy is getting the key to the city in Los Angeles, right? Is it in L.A. or somewhere? I think that's amazing.
I did not see that, but that's awesome.
Yeah, she's getting this, and it's going to be like, I think they're having a Stormy Daniels Day. I mean, she's really made her mark, I got to say. It's amazing if she's going to be the one to take this all this down, but... Now, I know if you listen to us, you are a fan of podcasting, and I bet chances are that you've thought about starting your own. But look, once you've recorded your own show, what's the next steps? How do you reach listeners and actually build an audience? Well, Audioboom can help with their $9.99 monthly subscription plan for hosting and distribution. With Audioboom's $9.99 subscription plan, you get 200 minutes of recording time for every episode, a branded homepage on the Audioboom platform, embeddable players for web and social media, unlimited storage, and episode scheduling. Plus, thanks to Audioboom's partnerships with the leading distribution and streaming platforms, your show could be eligible for placement on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And with Audioboom's advanced analytics, you'll be able to see how often your show has been downloaded, what devices your audience is using to listen to your show, the age, gender, and location of your listeners, and so much more. So to sign up for your $9.99 monthly subscription plan, go to audioboom.com/start and sign up today. That's Audioboom, audioboom.com/start, S-T-A-R-T. Sign up now and get the support you need to start your own podcast. That's audioboom.com/start.
What will not be the thing to take Trump down, however, is use of insecure communications devices. Now, I seem to recall that being like the number one important attribute for a president to have, at least during the campaign, was like using secure email devices and secure phones. In fact, I seem to recall that being the only thing we talked about for probably, 18 months. But Trump has lately been even more so than usual, apparently, using insecure cell phones to conduct business. Now, he has two cell phones. He has a tweeting phone and a talking phone. And his tweeting phone, apparently, he thinks it's too inconvenient to get it changed out, on a monthly basis. So he's held on to them for as long as 5 months. He also has a talking phone.
Okay, wait a minute. I actually missed this story. So are you saying that the president is supposed to change it out every month? Is that like the...
That was what they're trying to make him do, to try and make it more secure.
Okay.
But instead, he's been ignoring that because it's too inconvenient.
I mean, it's not going to be that hard for somebody to hack into it if they want. Maybe that'll make them change it. Can you imagine those DMs, though?
But also, one, there's an issue of like the phone being hacked into, which it looks like they have turned off like the microphone and the video capabilities. So possibly wouldn't be a huge problem. The concern there would be someone using his account to tweet out something very damaging.
Exactly. But more so than what he tweets, even.
The bigger problem is his talking phone, which has a microphone. And, I'm sure, God knows what he is using it to say. But, at the end of the day, as insecure as this is and bad as this is, it probably isn't. It's kind of like closing the barn door after the horse has left, because it's not like Sean Hannity's phone is going to be perfectly secure. And that's what Trump is calling every night for his little bedtime chats. Right. So you could just listen on Hannity's phone to get most of the intel you need.
Right. I mean, I do think sometime in our lifetime, maybe when we're really old and decrepit, the Trump tapes will come out. Everything he's ever said, kind of like the Nixon ones and other things. Yeah.
So in other news, the trade war has been temporarily called off. Never really started. But Trump was basically threatening to all kinds of things to China in terms of trade, because they've been ripping us off for so long. But none of the tariffs that were threatened actually came to pass. And we now have reports that they are pulling back. They're not being implemented. So basically, nothing has changed. Like, the situation is all roughly more or less how it was, with one exception. And that's that China's cell phone company, its government-owned cell phone company, ZTE, is going to get back into business in the U.S. Now, because of security concerns, a.k.a. China's authorities were using ZTE as a way to spy on American phone users, and also Iranian sanctions issues, they were fined last year. There was ongoing litigation. But Trump tweeted that, too many jobs were being lost in China because of this. So he was going to make sure they got fixed. So that's being worked on. Which means in this whole little standoff for the trade war, the U.S. has actually gained anything and China has already gained something. So great work negotiating
there. And so has Trump.
Well, that's the other thing. So America doesn't seem to have really made any progress on that front, to the extent that you can call any kind of tariff or trade war progress. But just before Trump did this little ZTE announcement, it seems that a business arrangement was made, which has a great benefit to a Trump-owned business. And that's that one of Trump's foreign business operations, like a resort sort of like theme park kind of deal in Indonesia, which Trump is going to be the manager for. It's going to be a licensed Trump resort property. China made a loan of $500 million to the bigger resort. Now, that's not a Trump-owned company. So the loan itself is being made to like the whole the Indonesian owner, his resort area. But the end result of that is that this complex is going to have a huge benefit, going to be able to be completed. And Trump's business as the manager of the Trump licensed property there, his interest would be greatly benefited.
And this happened. This loan was secured.
Days before.
Right. Like right leading up to the announcement that we're going to hold off on that trade war.
So it looks, I mean, is it corruption? We don't know. Does it look exactly like corruption? Yes. That's part of the problem with this thing is that like the way it's set up, the way Trump has his business operations operate is that like it is functionally indistinguishable between corruption and not corruption, which is a problem regardless of what's really going on. Even if everything was above board, the fact that it now looks to other countries like all you got to do is do something to help his business and you get a great benefit. That is hugely damaging to our foreign relations and to our, you know, internal democracy.
Yeah, but I mean, he has been fast and furious. I mean, it's pretty amazing, like within the first year of his presidency, how many other nations have tried to cash in and have cashed in on this presidency. I mean, like it's like an open market. The news, I mean, between like, you know, the UAE and Saudi, and I don't know how much we're gonna get into that, but I guess we will a little bit later. China, I'm sure there's all kinds of other places we don't know about quite yet, but they'll come up.
The countries getting most screwed over, the countries with strong anti-corruption laws and like a strong history of not being corrupt, which means our closest allies who aren't bribing Trump and therefore getting the cold shoulder.
Yeah, them and also American companies. I mean, I don't know if they're getting screwed over, but you know, Harley Davidson. I mean, I don't know if you followed that news that the Harley manufacturing plant just shut down after getting their nice fat tax break and doing a distribution to the shareholders and then shut on down. So folks in the United States are not doing too well. Moving on to North Korea, because, you know, a couple of great... First, there's this clip of Trump talking about, you know, the possible outcomes in North Korea. And honestly, he sounds completely unhinged. It just sounds like somebody who has no idea what he's talking about.
Well, the Libyan model isn't a model that we have at all when we're thinking of North Korea. In Libya, we decimated that country. That country was decimated. There was no deal to keep Gaddafi. The Libyan model that was mentioned was a much different deal. This would be with Kim Jong-un, something where he'd be there, he'd be in his country, he'd be running his country. His country would be very rich. His people are tremendously industrious. If you look at South Korea, this would be really a South Korean model in terms of their industry, in terms of what they do. They're hardworking, incredible people. But the Libyan model was a much different model. We decimated that country. We never said to Gaddafi, oh, we're going to give you protection. We're going to give you military strength. We're going to give you all of these things. We went in and decimated him.
So have you actually listened to it? Have you heard it?
Yeah. And it's not that he sounds completely unhinged, it's that he is. That's the real issue here.
He doesn't know what he's saying. I mean, basically he's kind of threatening like, oh, the Libya model. What is the Libya model? The Libya model is toppling the state and then just like killing somebody in the streets. That's the Libya model. That's his view.
What North Korea means by Libya model is where Libya, you know, cooperated to end its nuclear development programs. And the end result being its leader was like dragged out of a ditch and executed.
Yeah, I feel like that's not really the bait you want to use here. But, you know, on one hand, they have put out. Did you see this beautiful coin the White House put out for the summit?
It was not. So to be fair, it's not the White House that made it.
Oh,
it looks
really
ridiculous and absurd. Yeah. Well, they've always had these and they're always ridiculous and absurd. It just looks worse now when it's Trump.
Who creates them? And is the Mint? Who is this?
It's some like private company.
Okay. Oh, I actually thought it was like the White House orders, like the creation of these official coins. But anyhow,
They didn't design it, but it's absurd. And the problem is that like everyone basically in the world knew that North Korea was not actually trying to get rid of all its nukes, except for Trump. And now Trump figured out that North Korea is not going to hand over his nukes, and he is really unhappy about this because he thought he'd gotten this in the bag.
What do you think? Summit's going to happen or no?
Not going to happen. Or if it, I mean, I think at this point we're better off if it does not happen.
Yeah, that's because a loss for him, though. And he likes appearances. So I wonder if he'll still, like, force something to take place, even if it's just...
That's all he wanted, though. Like, that's where the danger is. Because he just wanted the appearances. Was so intent on making the appearances happen that as long as he can make it look pretty and look like a win, he'll give away anything. Which probably wouldn't be the worst outcome. Like, him, like, giving away the farm. Like, well, whatever. Maybe that's what we can hope for. But the worst result is that he ends up looking stupid. And then to retaliate, he does something drastic.
Like the Libya model.
Well, the problem with the Libya model is that the way he's saying it, he's using Libya model to mean we'll hurt you if you don't do what we want. But that only worked because Libya didn't have nukes. Right. North Korea does, which means you can't actually do what he thinks he wants to do.
I do think, though, North Korea and South Korea, I mean, I think they found a way to kind of humor him and kind of string him along, and they will do that again. Because at the end of the day, I don't think it's so much that he's itching to, like, destroy North Korea. He wants to win over the supreme leader, and he wants to make this a win in front of the entire world. Like, look what I did, that no other president could do.
He doesn't want war, but that could be the result. He doesn't get to choose that. If he keeps pushing on a path that's not sustainable, that can be the result whether he wants it or not.
Yeah, especially with Bolton in the wings. So,
So last week, the Senate Judiciary Committee released transcripts and exhibits from a bunch of interviews it did, I think all end of 2017, but all related to the June 9th Trump Tower meeting.
What is the Judiciary Committee?
Judiciary Committee.
Oh, okay, okay. I'm like, sorry.
I didn't realize that they were going to do it. It seemed to come out of nowhere, kind of. They're like, okay, here they all are. It was, I think Grassley made the call, but, you know, I'm glad they're out. I don't think their purpose was to try and help Trump, but we didn't have them before, now we do. Unfortunately, they probably raise more questions than they answer, which is basically everything in this damn case. But we do know more now about what happened in that June 9th meeting. As you might recall, there were 8 people total in that room. And let's start with a quick rundown of who all was there. And I am going to... I kind of want to use their first name because I don't actually trust myself to pronounce the Russian right. At all, or not butcher every single name I try and say.
You got it right, so look,
I'll give it a go.
Okay.
Well, the one I put Ike is actually Arakali Kavaladze. I have no idea. So, you know, I can read it.
Ike it is.
Let's call it Ike it is. Now, he is the Crocus guy. Now, Crocus is the company owned by Aris Agalarov, whose son is Amin Agalarov. They're the ones who arranged for Trump to have Miss Universe in Moscow in 2013 so that Amin could further his singing career. Essentially, they're oligarchs. They're actually Azerbaijani in origin, like ethnically, but they live in Russia. They're bajillionaires, and Ike is their guy who was in the U.S. And he's a bit his testimony is probably the most interesting to me because he comes across as pretty sincere. With a few times, you're like, oh, maybe you're not who you say you are after all. But he says like he's a Clinton supporter, and he was actually uncomfortable about the meeting because he wasn't so big on this idea of like negative information on Clinton being bartered about. And he was basically there as Crocus's representative, which is like, you know, Aris Agalarov's representative, which, okay, that makes sense. This meeting was arranged through Aris Agalarov, through his son's music promoter, who'll get to in a bit. But there's one line that really stands out to me in Ike's testimony that someone finally asked him, like, well, why are you here though? Like, this meeting was for, you know, the attorney to go and talk to Trump and Manafort and Kushner. And he says, my purpose was to read that longer synopsis, this is the write-out that Natalia V had, and my understanding was that the longer synopsis contained something which could alarm Mr. Agalarov about, you know, I would alarm him and he would call off the meeting. That synopsis was about the same thing, so there was no alarm or nothing. Now, putting in context, what he's saying is that his purpose here was to make sure that the meeting's going to be about something that it should be about. For some reason, his boss, Agalarov, was afraid the meeting would not be just about what they thought, and that this synopsis, like the meeting agenda, would contain something that would alarm Agalarov, which would cause him to, like, kibosh the whole deal. But no one asked him, what is that thing? What were you afraid of? What were you worried about?
Probably because they couldn't understand what he was saying, but I got to say, that's a really stupid strategy. I'm going to go to the meeting And you can't sound the alarm once you're in the meeting. It's happening right there.
Oh, they had a pre-meeting. They had a pre-meeting.
They had a pre-meeting. So he's talking about the pre-meeting before, when he said he went to the
before
pre-meeting.
Before the meeting, all the Russians and Rob Goldstone had like a lunch together. Or most of them did.
Got it. Okay.
And they went over the synopsis, which is like 11 pages, and explained them what it did go over. It's like Vinnytsiat, which, you know, is like the sanctions in Russia that Putin hates, and also all the adoption stuff, yada, yada, yada. So it seems like that there was a concern that when Natalia got into this meeting, she was actually going to bring up something different than what was discussed, and that they, if that happened, he was to call his boss, Agalarov, and be like, no, we cannot go ahead with this.
Okay. So not just the Russian adoptions.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I wish someone had thought to ask, like, okay, so it was it, but no one did. And that brings us to, and no one laugh at me, or go ahead and laugh because I laugh at myself, Natalia Veselnitskaya. Close enough. That is the former Russian prosecutor who's now a private attorney. And she represents Privazon, which is a Russian company. It's involved in a lot of Russian sanctions issues. And it seems like she kind of was the impetus behind this all. She used, well, it seems like she used Agalarov to set this up. And she went in there to, in theory, promote her client's interest by setting groundwork to end Russian sanctions. There was also Anatoly Samorchinov, which is Natalia's translator. And then we get to, Rob Goldstone, of course. He's British. He is the,
I like your description.
My notes have here. Yeah. A completely ludicrous human being in every respect possible.
There's so many of them, though.
Yeah. But he's number one. He's the best. He's Eamon's music promoter. He's trying to help this oligarch's son get his music career going. And he also, because of that and through, like, Miss Universe, he knew the Trumps. So he's the one who actually emailed Donald Jr. to be like, oh, the Russians want to help your father, and they've got some dirt on Hillary that we can share with you. And we know from the text he had with Eamon and conversations he had later that this was a favor for Aras Agalarov. So whatever all this was about, whatever it was done for, it was Agalarov asking for a favor. Okay. We get to the last person on the Russian side, and he is Renat Akhmetshin. Close enough. And he's the dark horse who shows up at this meeting at Trump Tower in like torn pink jeans because that's how he rolls.
I like that detail.
Yeah. And like a pink shirt detail. Too, apparently. Like this guy like shows up at Trump Tower with torn pink, like, I don't know, distressed pink jeans. It's hard to tell what they're describing. They sound stupid. And the story is that he was not planning to go to the meeting. Like he just got asked the last possible second. So he just waltzes in as he was.
Okay. Well, I mean, the jeans would seem to indicate the same, but...
Well, yeah, or is it that's too obvious, that's the cover story. Okay. So he's also a lobbyist for, quote, foreign adoption issues, or at least that's what he files on his, you know, Lobbying Disclosure Act paperwork, which means, again, Vinnytsiat. And he's been suggested to be a Russian agent, specifically someone connected to the GRU, which he totally denies, and which seems very unclear at this point whether it's possibly true or not. But his entire background is extremely dubious, and I do not think it's unfair to have an open question there about if he's who he really says he is. Then we get to the Trump side. We have Trump Jr. there, and his testimony is the most annoying and stupid of all the testimony so far in this whole Russia case, because Don Jr. essentially remembers nothing. He does not remember who he talked to about the meeting. He does not remember what he thought about the meeting. He doesn't remember if he thought about it at all. He does not remember what he felt about it. He does not remember if he had feelings about it. He does not remember what he thought after. He basically just says, I don't know, to every single possible thing about it. Like, what did you think when you heard about the meeting? I don't remember. Maybe I did think about it. Maybe I didn't.
Well, I mean, that's the smart way to respond, right? I don't recall, like, when you don't want to screw yourself over or get stuck somewhere.
There's a smart way of doing it, and there's the Don Jr. way of doing it. The smart way is to use, like, okay, I can't remember as a, you know, stonewall, which he's trying to do. But when you can't remember, like, essentially anything, you just come across like a dumb liar. And if you are not dealing with a very friendly GOP-controlled Congress, I doubt the questioners would have let him get away with that.
Right.
But what is very clear from the testimony of everyone else is that it's Don Jr. took this meeting thinking that he was getting dirt on Hillary. And the one thing he seems to have really asked during the meeting was after Natalia got into her whole, like, spiel about what was going on, at some point he turns and stops and says to her, either one person says, he asked if you have anything on Hillary, and someone else recalls him saying, so I believe you had some information for us. Huh. So he was thinking, like, okay, where's my Hillary dirt? And then there was
I mean, that's the only reason he agreed to take this. That's what Rob offered him, and that's why he was there.
And there was none there, so he was really annoyed and frustrated. And that's that. And Kushner does not seem to have really... So most people think he left the meeting early. The only person who recalls him saying anything is Ike, who remembers him saying, "Why are we here and why are we listening to this Magnitsky Act story?" And everyone says he seems very bored and annoyed and frustrated the whole meeting. And I actually believe them. I think that was genuine. I think that was actually totally legit and not a facade. That's just what Kushner was thinking at the time. Kushner was like really annoyed and like, "This is dumb. Why are we here? This is stupid." So that's the background, who was there and what the setup was. Now, the big question is, what the hell was actually going on? Like, what was this about? What's the deal? What's the real story? And we don't know yet.
I mean, it seems like it was like kind of like a fishing expedition. Like they're trying to see what the interest is with Trump's team, and then like how far, you know, like can they just bait them? Basically,
but who would be the fishing? Like. What's the goal there? Who is doing the fishing, and what's the offer? What's the payoff? There isn't any clear sign of any kind of like quid pro quo, or well, nothing related directly to, you know, Hillary Clinton's emails or anything like that.
Are you saying there's no collusion, Susan Simpson?
I am saying that on the surface, this meeting is hard to explain in any way. It's not that right. There's a legitimate explanation for it. It's just that there's no explanation that makes sense based on what we know so far. Now, one theory that the GOP was pushing in its questioning of all the witnesses is that this was actually a setup by Hillary.
Oh, my God.
And that's, you know what? Actually, I think that's a very valid area of inquiry. And I'm not sure I could rule it out either. Not that Hillary herself did it or that it was actually a Democratic thing or that even it was specifically a setup. But there is a lot of overlap here between the Russia side, the Russia bullet meeting, and Fusion GPS. In fact, that same trip, Natalia met with Glenn Simpson from Fusion GPS. They all know each other. They've done work together before on the Bill Browder, the actual Magnitsky Act, trying to fight against it. So that does seem strange. Like, okay, so you've got this person, this group investigating Trump's Russia ties, and people they've worked with on other matters are trying to entice Trump Jr. with Russia ties. So I think it's a very fair area to look into. The problem is it doesn't explain the Aris Aguilera side and how the hell he's involved or why he's setting this up.
How they got involved.
And it doesn't explain, the explanation does not account for a lot of what we know what did happen.
If this attorney was there talking about the Magnitsky Act, right? I mean, like that is, to me, that's kind of the ask. Like, this is what we're going to want from you, right? Like a change on this act. I mean, not having quite yet gotten to the what's going to be in exchange for it yet. It just seems like that would be where they would be headed. I mean, like, why else were they, you know, I mean, they baited them with the, you know, Rob Goldstone clearly said there's some dirt. I mean, there was some chatter about the dirt from before. Then they go in, they start talking about the Magnitsky Act, and then they just like shut off the meeting and leave. I mean, I feel like basically they didn't get a chance to get completely heard out. Like, what we're really saying to you is this.
I think it could be part of it, except if you're going to kind of do that, you'd want to make sure that people actually understood what your offer was. And I think that obviously that's a big...
They're idiots.
That is, but... But not everyone involved is that stupid in terms of if this was a quid pro quo offer, you wouldn't make it like this. You wouldn't make it in a context where it's really not hard to see how someone could miss the fact that there was a quid pro quo offer, especially when there was no quid being offered. Here's the quo or whichever one it was. I don't know if this is the quo or the quid, because they tell them in the meeting, they're like, okay, so where's the dirt in Hillary? And Natalia says, well, I don't have the dirt. You should go look into it. Here's where you should look, because we believe that the tax evaders, the Ziff brothers, are using their money to donate to Hillary and DNC. So go figure that out. But they don't give anything. So obviously Kushner and Don Jr. do not catch, if there was an offer, they don't catch on to it. But the other possibility here is that this was an actual lobbying effort. Like this was actually what Natalia says it was, and that she wanted to represent her client's interest. And as part of that, she went around talking to like congressmen and people in power. And that's what she says in her testimony. And like she says, they're like, well, why'd you talk to Don Jr.? And she says, well, Don Jr. probably knows lots of congressmen, so we wanted to use him to meet other congressmen. I mean, she probably knows more congressmen than he does. So that's a bit hard to believe on its fate. And also, like, what the hell is Don Jr. gonna do about Russian sanctions? He's the son of a presidential candidate. I mean, theoretically, I mean, obviously what they would have wanted is, like, if the election happened and Trump won, they want to use that influence. But this is not the way you do it if you were lobbying. And we know that from Ike, from his testimony, this is the Crocus guy, the guy who works for Aris Agalarov. He also thought this whole thing was weird. And apparently he kept saying, like, why are you meeting with Don Jr. or them? The way to do this is to go meet with the attorneys. The attorneys can understand this. You should explain it to them.
But I also what attorneys did he mean?
Like Trump's attorneys, which I also don't get, because what the hell are they going to do about Russian sanctions? Yeah. So yeah,
he's even weirder.
I mean, that seems to suggest there's something more going on, because, like, if he's this convinced, he's pretty, like, adamant about it. He's like, I didn't like the idea of the meeting from the start. I thought that it was a waste of time, that they needed to go talk to the attorneys, because the attorneys are the only ones that could really understand what was happening here. But, okay, sure. They could probably understand more than Don Jr. would. But what would they have understood exactly? What's the message here they're trying to pick up?
Right. And I don't know which lawyers are talking about, but at that point, it's not like there was White House lawyers involved. It's his personal attorney. So what role would his personal attorneys have in any of this? I don't understand.
And it also fails to account for the fact that in 2015, Rob Goldstone reached out to Rona Graff, Trump's secretary, and said, does Trump want to come over for Aguilera's birthday? By the way, we can set up a meeting with Putin and Trump. Okay, so clearly, this whole lobbying thing is not the whole story. If you can confidently offer a meeting with Putin, you aren't just freewheeling here. There is something bigger going on. So that brings us to a third possible theory, which, you know, no support for this one more than anything else, because who the hell knows what really happened here. But my guess at this point is that if something was happening, if there was a deeper meaning to this whole setup, it had to do with Renat Akhmetshin and Paul Manafort. And that's primarily because look at who set the meeting up. It is Rob Goldstone and Don Jr. And there is no one competent on earth who's going to use those two to do anything real. Like, the only purpose they have in any plan is as dupes. They can't be trusted with anything more. So if there was something occurring on a deeper level, they were just the means to the end.
Ooh, interesting. That's intriguing. That theory.
And it's the only thing I can think of, because of all of the testimonies about the Trump Tower meeting, there seem to be the most inconsistencies and, like, weird, not necessarily truthful sounding responses when it comes to Renat. And I think one of the biggest issues in the transcripts, and that's me, is that Ike, the Crocus guy, testifies that when the meeting started, he said, quote, at some point of time, right before the meeting started, Mr. Akhmetshin approached Mr. Manafort and suggested that they've met previously at some kind of meeting in Washington, D.C., like a conference or seminar or whatever. So from that, I assume they were introduced to each other. And Ike says that Manafort did not respond, didn't lift his eyes, just kept looking at his phone the whole meeting. Of course, Renat Akhmetshin, he denied that this happened, and he said he'd never seen Manafort before in his life. So, okay, maybe Ike misheard, but that's a very strange thing to mishear. So it's possible that whatever happened, the real purpose was to get those two talking. And both of them have the kind of shady past that would make them at least more plausible than anyone else there as people with different agendas.
It's really hard for me to see Manafort, like, as an uninterested party in this conversation.
Yeah, like, okay, he's the one there. He's the only one who's a real player. Kushner's an idiot. Donald Jr.'s an idiot. Neither of them have a damn clue what they're doing or why they're there. Manafort should have known something was up. He sat there in the meeting and did not say a damn word and just looked at his phone the whole time, to the point where everyone else thought he was just playing on his phone. Although he did...
He's probably texting Renat the whole time.
He did take some notes, like a few lines of notes about the meeting. But he, of all the people, he should have been on alert for something more happening here. And the fact that Akhmetshin tries to introduce himself sets up alarm bells for me. And it does seem like a lot of work just to have a meeting between two people, but it's also worth noting that until, like, spring 2016, there was an active FISA warrant on Manafort related to his previous dealings in Ukraine, which he could not have known was apparently expired at that time. So if he thinks he's actively under a FISA warrant and can be surveilled, which he was aware of based on his daughter's text messages, which talk about him always trying to engage in, like, these dumb acts of secrecy, maybe this was the only way around it, that he thought he could have a meeting with someone at a high enough level to sort of convey these extremely sensitive matters.
But it got no traction. It just was like, I guess at the end of the day, he's probably like, oh my God, these idiots didn't even pick up on what's happening here.
But the meeting was kind of in this, if this, that's what happened. And again, this is just one idea based on trying to put together all this stuff that doesn't seem to add up. The meeting itself was never supposed to go anywhere. The meeting itself was supposed to be a dead end. It was a cover story to get them all in the same room. Whatever was exchanged was not actually in the meeting. The terms.
But then why? I don't understand that. Get them in the same room to do what? Then have conversations outside of the meeting later? Just like what?
To get Manafort talking to a Russian spy in person and to possibly, who knows? But it's clear that they were concerned about like a transfer of documents. Well,
maybe
in this meeting.
A sting. Could it be a sting?
Who knows? But it is interesting that Akhmetshin was not actually part of the meeting until Don Jr. told them that he was bringing Manafort. Only after Don Jr. lets them know that Manafort will be attending do they suddenly say, oh, wait, we're going to have this other guy, Renat Akhmetshin, show up in his pink jeans. Which also had the effect of not needing him to be put on the security list by name. Because
that's true.
Who knows? I think we'll find out more, but I think the meeting itself was probably not the point. That was just the way to get everyone in place.
Okay. And then there was the second attempted redo in November of that year?
After the election. And they didn't ask questions about that as much either. But what happens is, you know, Trump wins the election, they're preparing for the transition, and Natalia V comes back to New York and is trying to get a meeting with Trump. And they're using Rob Goldstone to try and set it up. It does not happen. They do not want to go forward with it.
Of all people.
But at one point, Ike does transfer Rob $20,000 for no apparent reason, which my suspicion is it was, you know, his compensation for his efforts to try and set up a meeting, a second meeting. But again, no one asked about that at the hearing, so who knows? So the New York Times last week had a blockbuster article about the origins of the Russiagate investigation. It turns out the code name for this investigation was Crossfire Hurricane, based on the Rolling Stones song. I was born in a crossfire hurricane. What we know now is that the whole Russiagate investigation started on July 31st. 2016, mid-election, right after the Hillary investigation was closed. And their first act is to send two agents to London to talk to Alexander Downer. What seems like it happened is that we don't know exact timing, but after the DNC emails were leaked by WikiLeaks, Alexander Downer and the Australian government go, oh shit, you know that drunk guy told us about Russia having the emails and trying to use them to help Trump? Maybe that really matters. So they tell them about Papadopoulos, and the FBI goes into action. So that brings us to a part of the Operation Crossfire Hurricane, which is a really pretentious name for the record. If I was in charge of naming FBI investigations, they'd be way better, just saying. But that brings us to the thing that's gotten most tension lately from Trump, and that's the fact that there was an informant or a spy that they were using. Based on several articles, it now seems established that the man who is the informant everyone's complaining about, that Trump's complaining about, is a guy named Stephen Halper, who is now an academic and like a China hawk over in England. But, you know, he's like one of the old guard GOP guys. And what we know is that in July, mid-July, he met with Carter Page at a symposium in Cambridge. And then later, in September 1st, he met with Sam Clovis, who was the co-manager of Trump's campaign. And then later that month, he met with Papadopoulos, where he tried to quiz Papadopoulos about the Russia emails, and Papadopoulos denied having any knowledge of them, apparently. He was not part of the campaign. He just, you know, approached various members of the campaign and said, hey, let's talk about this stuff. And that was kind of it.
So basically, the FBI is trying to figure out if this is really a thing, if Russia really has like these emails. So he's not an actual agent, right? He's just like somebody who's cooperating with the FBI, this informant.
He's an informant. He's a confidential human source. Like he was working with them.
He's
like,
a CI.
Yeah, he was working with them. He's now been burned, which is, you know, a problem in itself, but. He was not embedded in the campaign. He was not, I mean, his contacts were relatively limited and at a distance in the sense that he was posing as an academic, just talking to people who happened to be part of the campaign.
And it doesn't sound like he really got anything out of it either.
Well, that's the part that's not clear. The current articles, which seem to be leaked by people involved from the Trump side, say that all they told Halper was that, oh no, we didn't get any emails. And like, why are you asking us about this? But Trump is pretty upset about it. And that brings us to the I hereby demand tweet.
That's the tweet. He tweets on Sunday, hereby demand, and we'll do so officially tomorrow, that the Department of Justice look into whether or not the FBI, DOJ, infiltrated or surveyed the Trump campaign for political purposes, and if any such demands or requests were made by people within the Obama administration.
Yeah, this brought us again to the brink of a constitutional crisis, because Trump is essentially using his office to investigate investigation into him. And also did so with the advice of his personal attorney, who was defending him in this action. So, yeah. Rosenstein, like he's always done, has survived by being infinitely flexible and quickly responded, okay, we're going to have the IG, the Inspector General of the DOJ, look into it. Cool, case closed. Which does put off the issue. It does shut down Trump's complaints. It pretends to respond to him. It does respond to him in a way that's not necessarily
damaging.
They
have a meeting, right? Didn't they show up for a meeting?
Well, that's where it brings us. So that was the first response. Then on Monday, Trump did have his official demand or whatever the hell it was. And now they're set for a meeting for Thursday. There'll be a meeting between the DOJ and Republicans in Congress and possibly the Senate now. But just the Republicans. The Democrats are no longer part of this because it's turned into a literally politicized intelligence. This is not how any of this ever works. Where they're going to go over and show information about the people the informant used to get information on Trump. Which is, to say it that way, makes it sound way less of a deal than it is. This is a huge departure from our norms, a huge departure from how things normally proceed.
It's crazy.
It's insane.
It's crazy that, yeah, that Trump can demand, like, basically, give me everything you got about you guys investigating me by the department. I mean, like, I don't understand. I mean, but I'm guessing that Rosenstein is just doing this to avoid having to step down. I mean, like, because that was what people expected, that this is going to put, you know, him in such a position that he's going to have to just step down. And that's what Trump wants anyways. So this is just a way to placate him.
It is. And one day history is going to judge Rosenstein on whether or not these compromises were worth it. We don't know the whole picture. Like, what he's doing is damaging to the DOJ. What Rosenstein is doing is damaging to our norms, to our rule of law. But that's not to say he's making the wrong call, because he is buying more time. He is putting off the inevitable crisis. And maybe that is the better way to proceed. And maybe America's better off by doing this for now. But we don't, it depends on
the... We don't know.
We don't know. Although there are signs that Mueller may be approaching some kind of big point investigation. So perhaps all they're looking for is a few
more
weeks.
What are those signs? The Papadopoulos sentencing or what?
Yeah, Papadopoulos, everything ahead with sentencing there. Same for Flynn. They're not putting it off anymore, which means they expect, some one way or another, some kind of resolution for those cases, which maybe doesn't mean anything.
I read that a couple of some of Mueller's attorneys are not just working as, like, within the special investigation, but also have signed off on some pleadings as special assistant USAs. Or special AUSA, special assistant U.S. attorneys, which would help expand the investigation if they were working in that capacity, in response to, like, Manafort's counsel trying to get, like, stuff dismissed because of the allegation that he's overstepping, like, the parameters of his mandate.
I did not see that.
So I don't know what that means.
But
yeah, that was reported by, let's see, who was reported by? Well, it's been reported by The Hill.
So yeah, I mean, it could be, that could be explained why Rosenstein's making all these compromises, is that he's making the call that buying a little more time is worth the cost. And the cost is real.
He should reschedule for, like, next week.
You know, it
works. Call in sick.
Yeah, it's a scary time in America because
yeah,
the naked corruption alongside rule of law being undermined, and the most concerning of all, as always, is the Republican Congress's capitulation to all of it.
That's the thing. Yeah, yeah. They're going along with it. It's amazing, the precedent they're setting here.
I mean, it's incredible. It's a miracle that Rosenstein is still there. So, it's, again, we're not in a place to judge yet if his constant appeasing and his hanging on was worth it in the end. Because if it was not Rosenstein there, if it was someone like Comey or McCabe or anyone else, they would have been like, oh, fuck it, bring it on long ago.
Right.
Comey would have done something sanctimonious long before now. Rosenstein has no sanctimony whatsoever. He has no, I wouldn't say, it's not that he's being unethical, but, like, he has no problem giving his appearance away. Like, okay, Trump, you want me to be on your team? I'm on your team. Okay, Trump, we're doing it this your way. He'll avoid confrontation and will not make a stand.
But the question is to what end? I mean, like, you know, what, why? Like, why is he doing that? Like, is he doing it because he's really trying to, he really wants to be loyal to Trump here? Or
no.
Is he doing as cover for Trump? Or is it because he's just trying
time.
To buy time and do the right thing?
He's buying time. I think full stop. Like, that's what he's doing here. It's just, like I said, we'll have to have history be the judge of whether or not that was the right call.
So basically, he's going to show up tomorrow, and I know John Kelly demanded this, and him and the IC are going to turn over to this meeting. Is it going to be a closed meeting? closed meeting, right?
Yeah. Republicans. It was just House Republicans, just Nunes and all them. But now, like, last I saw, this was a few hours ago now, I think Grassley and Graham and maybe some others had written to say, we want to be there, too, from the Senate.
I don't think they'll get an invite.
But no, well, they might. They might be in because Republicans are cool. It's just Democrats are excluded. Which brings us to the final point of the episode, which is what the hell this is all about. And my title of this section was The New Conspiracy Theory Hotness, because the old hotness is out. This is the new hotness. And this is, I mean, as usual, the broader theory is the same. This is all a deep state plot to take down Trump. But Trump has gone openly batshit with the whole deep state conspiracy thing. He's tweeted the words deep state, which he rarely doesn't actually do that often until recently. Which is that the FBI was trying to take down Trump by a fake Russian investigation that would use to help Hillary win. But of course, at its core, this whole idea doesn't work at all, because if it was a plot to undermine Trump and to help Hillary win, why did no one ever use it to help Hillary? Why did no one take any action whatsoever to help Hillary win?
In fact, I would say that it's inaction at the time. I mean, I think I put some blame at the feet of the Obama DOJ that they didn't take the right action at the time.
They made the call, and maybe maybe without the benefit of hindsight, it was the right call, and that they didn't want to undermine democracy by politicizing this. They took a cautious approach. I think it probably was not the right call, but again, honestly, I think if I was in Trump's shoes, I probably would have made a similar call. Like, this is not worth, will cause more harm long term.
In Obama's shoes, yeah.
Yeah, if that was president, you know. So that's the Trump variation. It makes no sense. There is a more sophisticated, I use that word loosely, a more sophisticated version of this theory that they're putting out, and that's the entrapped and planted claim. Okay. And this theory is that the FBI spied on the Trump campaign by having someone embed themselves in the campaign to entrap and plant evidence as an insurance policy in case Trump got elected. So this theory is that they weren't trying to help Clinton win. It was like, if Trump wins, we need a way to sabotage him after. So that's how they avoid the explanation for why no one used it to help Hillary win. It was just to be used in case Trump won. But what it does suggest is that they are actually very, very worried about this informant, the spy, Holper. Because the way they're talking about Trump's campaign being entrapped or stuff planted, it's just there's something there. The story that all of them told Holper, oh, we had no emails, that doesn't make sense if that's what really happened. Based on what Trump's saying now, it sounds like they think he has something very damaging, possibly stuff that was used to get the FISA warrants on Carter Page and anyone else that got him on. They're trying to preemptively explain it by saying, oh no, this was not real evidence. It was either Trump campaign staffers being entrapped by this like sting operation, or it was fake evidence planted by Holper.
Fake evidence, huh? I mean, look, here's my thing. If he has the kind of people in his campaign who can be, it's not entrapment if it's like, if they really are people who are shady and doing things that are like unethical or criminal. I mean, entrapment is a whole different thing. Yeah. It's like when there is absolutely no conspiracy and like an agency, a government agency, law enforcement, whatever, creates a conspiracy on its own. If anything, it seems like this guy, the spy, was just there to figure out what's, you know, who's doing what.
Yeah, but let's say hypothetically.
They can't be entrapped unless they were doing something wrong.
But let's say hypothetically, Carter Page and Sam Clovis said things to Holper that suggested they had foreknowledge of the emails and that Russia was going to use them to help Trump win.
Sure.
That would explain, like, that takes away the whole argument that the FISA warrant wasn't justified, takes away a lot of their claims. And they've got to find a way to make that be part of the deep state plot. And the constant use of the words like entrapped and planted is weird because those are not the same concept. Entrapped means, again, like you invite someone to do something and you trick them into doing a crime that they wouldn't have done on their own. But planted means fake evidence that you put in there to try and frame someone. So they're going for the both prong approach. There was both entrapped people who were entrapped into doing crimes and then fake evidence of crimes planted. So yeah, I think the Holper stuff is a big problem for the Trump campaign, and they are trying to beat it from release, or beat it to the punch. It's coming out.
Is this, by the way, related to the new hashtag impeach Obama that's been trending?
What is wrong with those fuckers? Like,
I don't know.
I saw the one, it's like the real person afraid of impeachment. isn't President Trump, it's Obama. I'm like,
Yeah. Obama's terrified of being impeached right now.
Yeah. Right now, yeah.
As he just signs a $300 million Netflix deal.
Right. Impeached off Netflix.
Yeah.
So that's where we currently stand. I think tomorrow is going to be a very fun day because there's a really good chance that once the House gets to see, even if just Republican members of the House gets to see those documents, they're going to leak like a sieve. So we'll all know pretty soon, I suspect, what exactly Halper heard.
Well, no, but like so much other stuff that's come out, it's like you're going to have people just reading it whatever way they want to read it. I mean, the GOP will say this is total evidence of like
entrapment, the deep state. And planting.
Exactly. And I mean, it's just, I used to get excited about this kind of stuff. Now I'm like, it's just going to be more of the same bullshit, I think.
That's their whole strategy, and it's working. Americans are not following. Mm-hmm. There's so much going on, and there's so much noise coming from the Trump camp that everyone assumes that like, it's not that big a deal. Like, okay, sure, it's something, but it's not that big one. All of it is, in fact, huge and far bigger than any scandals that happened in the Obama era.
Yeah.
Which, unfortunately, means that we don't have time this week for the Broidy stuff I was working on. But I'm sure we'll have lots more on Broidy next week.
There's a very, very juicy stuff coming out about Broidy and the other things that I mentioned earlier, like the UAE-Saudi connections and Sharon Bouchard, who we think was totally not connected to Broidy anyways. All right. Okay. So I guess we're going to have to see. My fear is like we're going to like push it next week and then we're going to have like no time. But because we're recording later in the week, hopefully we won't be so overwhelmed with news in the next 4 or 5 days that we can actually cover it because it's big news. So
Broidy we'll get into for sure. We'll see what happens otherwise.
Sounds good. All right. Well, Susan, thank you so much. You basically dug down deep and explained a lot of stuff. Even I have been, I'll be honest, Ramadan's wiping me out. So I'm barely lucid. Anyway, thanks so much. And all right, all our listeners, we'll be back in less than 7 days, if all goes well. Take care, Susan.
Bye.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.